Just a little note on study. Some of these things, that study is not the same as gathering information. So when you study a text or some piece of the Dharma, you usually have to go over it a lot. So like that fourfold phrase I suggested to you is, it's just four lines really, but if you memorize it and you repeat it, then it becomes part of your, it's like an echo, a really wholesome echo in your consciousness. And then that echo comes up as you live your life, and it becomes a kind of dharmic lens from which you look at life. That's what contemplative study is about, as opposed to simply gathering information and accumulating more knowledge. And the thing about Buddhist studies, it's like this is just one volume of the Pitaka. You know, it's like there is a lot there, and you can get totally overwhelmed with that information. If you have no information, if you have no knowledge, you're like a ship without a rudder. So you do need to have, otherwise why have a Buddha? Why not just go for it yourself, right? So you need knowledge that acts as your rudder in the way you're investigating and putting forth effort and so on. But just getting more knowledge takes most people to doubt, actually. It doesn't really liberate, whereas if you take knowledge deeply as opposed to broadly. So a scholar, like I'm just reading this book on the philology of Buddhism by a very brilliant translator, Norman, and the guy he's got a mind like Minnesota. Just this huge, huge capacity to take in ancient Asian languages, and just brilliant intellect. But I read it and I just had information. On one hand, it's his information, and it's just knowledge. Yeah? Whereas if I take something like a sutta passage, Four Noble Truths, and I work with that for 10 years, yeah? Or like Ajahn Sumedho has been deepening his understanding of the Four Noble Truths for close to 50 years, then it's a whole different kind of use of knowledge, isn't it? It's a deepening of insight through knowledge. So not to dismiss knowledge, to see where, like in comparative religion, if you're doing a PhD in comparative religion, that's a different realm. You're comparing maybe Advaita Vedanta and Theravada Buddhism or something like that, and you get comparative ideas, and that has validity. So when I see people trying to compare different religious traditions with this one, I said, yeah, okay, big deal. So maybe there are some comparisons, but that's not the point of it. It's not an exercise in being clever, right? And you can get, or you read books about the Buddha, the lost years of Jesus, and you find his gravesite in Tibet, and everyone's gaga over that. So what? How does that really help you liberate? So people think they know something more, but all that, they've just got a different narrative now. You know, Jesus did this and then he did that, but that narrative is just a story. Whereas like contemplative reading is where you mull it over. When you read it, you don't read it to get through it. When you read it, you pause, and you maybe go over a line again and again. Again, we all do that, don't we? And that's a different way of that's study. That would be contemplative study. And then if you get something that strikes you, then you usually, like, I like to write stuff out. Most of us have a notebook of things which we find really pithy, and then just go back to the notebook and review it, memorizing, we do a lot of that. We memorize a few phrases, a few lists, and then that becomes a part of your memory system. And it's very helpful because it just pops up. It's interesting, it'll just pop up. And then you practice. You try to use those words and so on, and then maybe 10 years later you understand it. it's interesting how you'll kind of see a text, you'll understand it at some level, and then you'll practice for many years and you come back to the text, oh, I see what that means. There is a sort of, oftentimes there's a layers of depth in the teachings. So anyway, I thought I'd just read that whole thing, just that little bit I read last night, with that in mind. In the Pali text, you get a lot of repetition, because for the translator it's just much easier. But if you remember, these tradition has it that these texts were passed on orally. They were what they call groups of monks who memorized groups of texts, and they chanted those. And other monks would correct them in their memory. So it was it's kind of like the genealogy of old cultures, where they remember the genealogies and they're able to recite them. And well, in the same way, the suttas were committed to memory and they're only written down later. So when you see repetitions, realize like the reciter is using, you know, he's going through those repetitions again and again and again. And repetition lodges ideas in your mind. That's what it's about. So sometimes when we read it in a kind of intellectual way, we just kind of skip over it. Oh yeah, I've seen it. Okay, all right. Like when I read a book and I want to get through it, I just do, I usually do first few paragraphs and last paragraph. You know, everyone does that, right? That's how you get through a book. And you kind of generally know what it's about. But that's just getting information. On seeing a form with the eye, so this is right at the end of the sutta, the conclusion. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not lust after it if it is pleasing. He does not dislike it if it is unpleasing. And you can take that line for a year. Right, you can just keep contemplating that. A form of the eye, and then use the other senses. Pleasing, displeasing, does not dislike if it is unpleasing. You see how that suggestion to your mind would make you more aware of the nature of contact, pleasant and unpleasant, how it leads to liking and disliking, etc. It just would make you more aware, so your awareness would be more refined, more continuous. He abides with mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable mind, and he understands it as he actually is the deliverance of the mind and the deliverance by wisdom, wherein those unskillful, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So then you'll get to things like immeasurable mind. You'll think, okay, what the heck's that about? And that's part of the exercise, because you don't know yet. You don't know what that means. You know, it's not like, oh yeah, I get it. And like, it's not like a joke. It's got a punchline. There's a lot you don't know. You actually don't know. And that makes you ponder. So it's an immeasurable mind. What that is. So then you go, you look up immeasurable. Immeasurable. Okay, you get a feeling. And that kind of immeasurable brings up a kind of query in your mind, a kind of investigative query. But if whatever the book says, what immeasurable means, it's still only information. But now what's immeasurable? You start to ponder, what would be immeasurable? You want me to tell you? and he understands this actually is the deliverance of the mind and deliverance by wisdom. Deliverance, what would deliverance mean? Liberation, freedom, deliverance. Where are you being delivered to? The hospital? So you get phrases now which are difficult, and that's the point of it. It's supposed to be difficult. If it was easy, it wouldn't take a Buddha. And then that makes you look, then you cross-reference, don't you? You see, what does a commentary? So you go into commentary, what does that say? Deliverance is some freedom. And then that makes you ponder more, and that's how you study in a contemplative way. Right? That's how you use the text in a contemplative way, not just kind of... And they're not easy, but it's not chicken soup for the heart, right? Let's get a bit more... a bit more guts in it. I'm going to get in trouble here. I'll get a note about it. But what I'm pointing to is that difficulty is not to be avoided. Just because something's difficult, well, that's too difficult. I don't know what I'm going to do with that. That would be a kind of insult to your own intelligence. But the difficulty has its point. That, I mean, some things are that just, you just go over them, oh, I don't understand that at all. But sometimes they grab you, and that's what study's about. That's how you study. That's how you study a text. That's how you grapple with it. having thus abandoned favoring and opposing whatever feeling he feels, whether painful or pleasant, or neither painful nor pleasant, he does not delight in that feeling, welcome it, or remain holding to it. So that's a bit more understandable, maybe, holding to it and so on. But you see what this is doing to the mind. It's making it kind of think in this way. As he does not do so, delight in feeling ceases in him. With the cessation of his delight comes cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of being. With the cessation of being, cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So then you start to kind of, what is being? Cessation of being, clinging. And those are key words in the Theravada tradition. So you have to, like in studying Theravada Buddhism or any system of thought, you have a certain technical language too. So the word clinging, upadana, you find that throughout the text, so you have to grapple with it. What does this mean by clinging? Not just my idea. So you go to the dictionary, you go to some source texts, and then so you struggle with that, and you see that, and you get a feeling for that. And if you don't do that work, so I'm talking about the work of study now, how to use knowledge. If you don't do that work, then you don't get the key words, and there, you don't need to know that many words, but you need to know some really key words, because they're just brought up in the text again and again and again and again. And if you haven't really, again, tried to figure them out in your own heart, then when they come up, you always have some sense of doubt. So there's a technical language in Theravada Buddhism. You know, tanha, craving, is a technical word which has a specific meaning. And so you have to spend some time in study. I mean, if you want to take on the text, if you want to take on a system, you have to kind of get your head around some of the basic words and some of the basic structures. Because then once you've done that, intellectually, you have a rudder. You don't just fall into, you know, it's like you don't just sort of read Rumi and think, well, that's neat, I like Rumi. And then you do a bit of Advaita Danta, oh, I like that. And then you listen to a tape by Joseph Goldstein, oh, he's pretty smart, you know, and then you kind of hear me, and then it's all just sort of kind of entertainment, and maybe inspiring, whatever, but quite often intellect doesn't have a real integrity, wholeness, I suppose. You know, we have the whole teaching as a piece, and it is a piece, you know, it makes logical sense all around, right? And so that requires the work of the intellect. So, and then it goes on hearing a sound with the ear, so on smelling an odor with the nose. So when I study that, then I do the repetitions. On hearing the sound of the ear, he does not lust after it, if it is pleasing, and so on. So then I go through the repetitions, and the repetitions kind of push it into consciousness more strongly, because I'm reading it again, I'm reminding myself of it again. And so on, smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body. So now I skip the repetitions, but you can see if I could take the time to repeat the repetitions, then that would lodge more strongly in my consciousness. On cognizing a mind object with the mind, he does not lust after it if it is pleasing. So a mind object with the mind. What's that? He does not lust after it if it is pleasing. He does not dislike it if it is unpleasing, etc. With the cessation of his delight comes cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of being. So what does cessation of being mean? Does that mean when you do this, you're nothing? You know, that's the kind of, you know, that's a kind of doubt I would have. Cessation of being. Do I just disappear? You know, is it vanish? Obviously not. You know, but, so what does that mean? Being what? What do they mean by that? So your own, hopefully, you're stimulating doubt to some extent, but now the doubt is directed to be a mode of questioning through the teaching, not just an abstract doubt. With the cessation of being, with the cessation of being, cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Bhikkhus, remember this deliverance through the destruction of craving is taught by me in brief. So that if I were to, you know, if I found that text interesting, or my teacher said that was a good text, and I went over it every day for a month, say, every day for a month, that would be totally different, just kind of reading it, okay, and then give me the next one. So reading for uplift, quite often you just read something, you feel uplifted, but reading for contemplation takes much more work, takes time. You have to give it time, you have to have some samadhi, you have to have, your mind has to be composed, and then you have to be willing to be a scholar to some extent, but a scholar from your own interest, rather than just being a scholar for the sake of a kind of abstract, it's more an internal kind of study. And then from that, imagine if you read that, if you found it helpful in some way, and you read that every morning for a month, that would be powerful. Memory would come up, and some of that language would come up, and then the way you'd contemplate your existence would be through that. So we say you try to establish right view with knowledge. That's pariyatti, study, and then you try to then establish right understanding through practice, patipatti. And then when those are conjoined and you see things the way they are, you start to seem like the Buddha sees, and that begins to liberate your mind. So study is important. I was emphasizing how we can get caught up in intellect, so I just wanted to balance that, to not think that you don't need to study, you don't need to have a rudder, you don't need direction, you do need direction. Okay, let's do some sitting.